Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Irina Zhorov. The University of Wyoming Board of Trustees announced UW President Bob Sternberg's resignation on Thursday after less than 5 months on the job. The trustees spent Thursday and Friday in meetings, but President of the Board David Bostrom sat down to talk with Wyoming Public Radio about what comes next. Bostrom says the trustees did not try to convince Dr. Sternberg to stay.
In conversations with Bob, he was pretty firm in his commitment to leave. He indicated he was going to resign and did so. And the trustees, as I said yesterday, accepted his resignation with understanding. And, you know, his stated reasons, you'd have to visit with him. The reality was that, in my mind, he had come to that decision and that the decision was final.
The search process was mostly confidential, and that was sort of controversial in the state and certainly in the university community. So considering the resignation after, you know, not even 5 months, do you think the process failed at some point?
No, I don't think the process failed. We did our due diligence as best we could. We used a search firm, brought us a broad pool of candidates. We had committees that went through and did vetting. It was all done, and I don't think that the process was flawed. I think it worked very effectively. There are times, and I think you have to look at Dr. Sternberg's statement, that I'm resigning because this was just not a good fit. I guess some people can say that it failed. I certainly do not believe that it failed in any way.
Has there been any discussion yet about changes to the process in this upcoming search?
Too early to ask that question. This just happened late afternoon, day before yesterday. We spent all day yesterday getting things finalized, coming to the press conference yesterday afternoon. We will have a session at an upcoming board meeting discussing what we're going to do going forward. Will there be a search process involved? What will that search process be? When will it occur? All of those are things that we just can't. We've got to allow some time, and we've got to give some very serious thought to what we're going to do in going forward with the presidency of the University of Wyoming.
In terms of budgeting, how much does it cost to, like, for that whole process? And, you know, if you do end up going through a process, is that going to be a concern going forward?
Well, budgeting is always a concern. I quite honestly don't. I don't have those numbers in my head on what the cost of a search is. The other question is, to determine what those costs are going to be, we have to do what I said previously. We have to determine what that process is going to be, how it's going to be conducted, and then we will have to budget for that going forward. But at this point, I can't tell you what that number is.
People were obviously upset about the personnel changes, but the trustees decided to keep the changes that were made. I'm wondering why that decision was made.
Well, personnel changes that were made were, as I said, accepted and endorsed by the trustees. We were aware of what was going on. We endorse and accept them and have in place now a good cadre of people, of vice presidents, of deans, of directors. We have a team that Dick McGinnity is going to be able to work with going forward. And so we're not looking back at where things were. We're starting at this point and going forward. And has that created a new direction? Yes, in a way it has. Anytime you bring in new people, that's going to happen. So the board, again, accepts and endorses the changes, and we are going forward where we are. We're not going to look back.
The fact that the changes are staying in the new direction, will that change either the pace of healing or how healing goes forward for the university community from here on out?
Well, I think that the university community understanding that this is where we are, we're going forward, we're not going back. Now it is time to put the seat of our pants in the seat of the chair, as John McPherson would say, and go to work with calmness, recognizing that what we are all about is a university, and our outputs are students. And if we all go to focusing back on the students and the research, because we are a research institution, and we focus on those things, I think that allowing that healing, if that's what you wish to call it, will work itself through the process. Because if we all remember and focus on what we're supposed to be doing, the outputs of students to fill jobs in the state of Wyoming and making certain we train those students in the skills that are necessary for the state of Wyoming. I think that healing process, I'm not even sure it's a healing process, but I think the process of going forward in a positive environment is what everybody needs to focus on. And I think we have the very definite ability to do that.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
It's not often that a president leaves a university as quickly as Sternberg did, but it has happened before at UW. We're joined now by historian Phil Roberts. He says there are often times that people are just not the right fit for a particular position.
Pretty much the last time that it happened at the University of Wyoming was back in the middle 1960s with a new hire for president by the name of John King. And King came to UW from Emporia State, and I think the problem was that he didn't really fit very well with Wyoming. There were some things that he could have done that would have made him a better fit, and one would be to study up on the culture and study up on the history and ask a lot of questions and spend a good deal of time in preparation, because if there's one criticism that the faculty and the deans and the general public and eventually the trustees had about King was that he didn't seem to be either very well informed about the institution, nor was he very curious about how the institution worked. The University of Wyoming isn't that unusual, but and it's not really that hard to understand Wyoming, but if you don't do those fundamental things, I think you do set yourself up for some potential trouble.
Now, this time around, there was controversy about Sternberg even before he was hired. There was controversy about the search process being secret. Was there any controversy in King's case about, you know, the hiring process?
I think the hiring process was fairly standard, but you have to take into account the fact that that was before the days of instant communication. It just wasn't that easy to communicate. But transparency has always been a really important aspect of the University of Wyoming, given that we're the only four-year institution in the state and everybody feels that they have a stake in what goes on down here and they really want to know. They don't like anything that smacks of secrecy or lack of transparency. And I don't like to say I told you so about such things, because I think many of the Board of Trustees recognized it from the get-go that kind of a search was just not pretty antithetical to the way Wyoming usually does things. But I think circumstances sort of build up in a way that caused a hasty decision to be made without recognizing that maybe the institution and Dr. Sternberg didn't share a similar vision. Really, they weren't a very good fit. But to their credit, at least, both parties, both Dr. Sternberg and the board, I think came to the realization that ultimately it was just not a good fit. And that sometimes doesn't happen. It was not the case with Dr. King, because Dr. King, contrary to Dr. Sternberg, Dr. King sought to stay in place and failed to recognize that he wasn't a good fit with the institution, and that caused some rancor at the end of his term here at UW.
So did they fire him then?
Ultimately, it's what it turned out to be.
Now, one of the things that has caused a lot of concern here on the campus community and elsewhere as well is the departure of so many deans and other officials during Sternberg's brief tenure in office. Is that something that we've seen happen before? How typical is that?
That seems to be very atypical at UW. Generally, transitions occur at the top levels and the deans stay in place and the new president works with the deans, and sometimes over the course of the following months or years, it's determined that they're not on the same ground and a dean will step down or depart, but it just doesn't happen in a mass way like it has here over the past 3 or 4 months.
I guess just the last question is there anything from history, whether that's from John King or anyone else that we should really be looking to right now as we move forward from this?
I think the most important thing is to spend some time at the beginning making sure that there is a good fit and allow for a lot of people in on the conversations.
Phil Roberts is a historian at UW. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about people in drug court who are finding the benefits of yoga and have an interview with a survivor of the Guatemalan massacres of the 80s. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Willow Belden. Lots of people enjoy the calming and relaxing benefits of yoga. But in Laramie, a group is trying to use yoga to help those in a drug court program. And the early returns are good. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
It's Friday night at Laramie's Hot Power Yoga. The lights are down and the room is lit with candles. Nine people connected with the Albany County Drug Court Program are here holding various poses in an effort to relax and focus. The class is part of an experiment by the Drug Court, which is now known as the Court Supervised Treatment Program. The program coordinator is Tina Mansfield. She says those assigned to the drug court have issues.
Someone who has had many legal problems that are strictly and completely due to addiction.
Mansfield says people in the program can relapse over and over again, but she adds that those who run the program learn a lot from relapse. One thing they've learned is that participants need a way to reduce stress and focus on something positive, and that's where yoga comes in.
Yoga is a gift. Yoga is an opportunity for a participant to be there for themselves and not have any demands on themselves for an hour.
A drug court participant named Jen Banks recently discovered the benefits of yoga on her own. Banks was no casual participant in the system. Mansfield calls her experience as grisly as anyone's. Banks says she was hooked on the benefits of yoga almost immediately.
What happened was I came in the first day and I cried and I was like, oh my gosh, this is like life changing. And so through the yoga, I found a different type of structure because the poses are specific and they hold you in a certain way. And through that structure, I could sort of work through all this stuff that I'd held, like bodily trauma. And then I quit smoking cigarettes. Never thought that would happen in a million years.
Banks has become an instructor and brought the idea of leading a class designed for the drug court participants to Mansfield, who embraced the idea. Since she knows what they're going through, Banks focused on trying to heal their wounds.
Once again, no judgments, but maybe try and soften those thoughts and soften your heart and know that ain't nobody gonna come in the studio and harass you for this 2 hours. It's sacred space. It's your time for your body.
Another instructor with the program, Alyssa Yakeley, says there is no question that yoga helps those in the program.
The idea is you're actually kind of life practicing. You're practicing putting yourself in relaxing places, in less than relaxing postures, and then figuring out how to be relaxed. And it really starts to work on your nervous system from the outside in.
Now, admittedly, this new age talk might make cynical people roll their eyes. But the participants say it is working. Tyler Wall is shocked by the benefits. After a busy and stressful week, he'd normally spend his Friday nights drinking to excess, instead of being in a yoga class.
Clears your mind, puts a lot of things in perspective. You don't feel the need to go drink because you're a lot happier after doing something like this, and just overall boost your mood.
Kathy Johnson has been doing yoga since the spring and raves about how it's helped her.
It gives you that meditation feeling, and I can actually focus into a world of no pain, no frustration, no anger. You know, it's complete silence almost.
Will this continue to work? It is anybody's guess. They now call the program Wyoming Mobile Yoga and have plans to take it around the state and even into the correction system. The drug court's Tina Mansfield is excited about the possibilities and says even if it helps just a few people, it is worth it.
Closing the eyes brings any fear or anxiety into your mind or your body. See if you can imagine that they're actually open when you're just looking at the backs of your eyelids.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Allowing the jaw to hang heavy off the skull.
Anselmo Roldan Aguilar is from Guatemala. He was a young man when the Guatemalan military attacked his town and killed more than 400 people. This was in 1982, in the midst of Guatemala's internal armed conflict, during which hundreds of thousands were massacred. Roldan Aguilar is now president of the Association for Justice and Reconciliation, an organization seeking justice for the massacre survivors and perpetrators. He visited the University of Wyoming to meet with students and talk about his experience and AJR. Work and stop by the studio to chat as well. Ellen Moore served as his interpreter.
Bueno, yo ya tenía mis 17 años de edad cuando sucedió esta.
I was about 17 when the massacre happened in the Ishkan region where I'm from. And so I'd heard of other cases in other communities where they'd disappeared people or burned down houses. And so I no longer visited the market where people went to trade goods to sell things. And so it was a Sunday market day, March 14th, when the army came to my community. And it was that day on Sunday when the people got together to sell their goods. And so at about 10 in the morning, a helicopter came and flew over the community. And so at the same time, you started to hear the bombs dropping and the gunfire. We just heard a lot of gunfire. I had to flee into the mountains, into the forest. A lot of people died that day. Later, I went to look for my family, and I couldn't find them. And later, I realized that 9 members of my family had been killed. So 8 days after the massacre, I went back to the community and I saw that the army had burned everything. And so that's what happened in my community. More than 400 people were killed, among them men, women, the elderly, children.
And so how did you start organizing after that? And how did you get involved in this sort of ongoing search for justice?
Como nosotros, después de toda la violencia, tuvimos que salir.
So after the violence, I went to Mexico. A number of people went to different parts of Mexico as refugees. Other people went to the United States. And so we returned in 1993 to Guatemala after being in Mexico. And they signed the peace accords in 1996. But the human rights violations continued after the peace accords were signed in 1996. And so this gave me the energy or the interest in continuing to organize in defense of human rights. That pushed me to form an organization with about 5 or 6 other people. In order to seek justice and bring into the light the truth of what happened in 1982 and 1983.
You've been attacked and threatened for your work seeking justice from the perpetrators of the genocide. Did you ever think to stop, or were you ever discouraged by that?
Sí, bien amenazas tuvimos cuando.
So yeah, we had a lot of threats, most of them right after we presented the legal charges against Efraín Ríos Montt and Romeo Lucas García in 2000 and 2001. But I always remained enthusiastic and committed despite the fact that someone attacked me and attempted to take my life. I was clear about what I wanted, to find the truth and to find those who were guilty for the human rights violations during the violence. And I was also clear that this didn't just happen in my community, but it happened throughout the country.
As you say, you helped file charges against former dictator Romeo Lucas Garcia and against Efraín Ríos Montt, who played a role in the killings. Montt was convicted, and then the conviction was quickly overturned earlier this year. What do you think the current Guatemalan courts and government have the capacity and desire to do in terms of delivering justice?
La verdad, hablando del gobierno,
so the current president, Otto Pérez Molina, doesn't have the political will to uphold his own national laws in Guatemala. And so after the peace accords, there was a lot of talk of democracy, but we see today that the government doesn't have the capacity to mediate these sorts of conflicts and to uphold the law. And so there was that court that heard the case that wanted to set a precedent in Guatemala and wanted to strengthen the rule of law, but they weren't allowed to do that. The judicial system needs to be independent, and they need to be able to uphold the rule of law and the national laws that have been established in the country. The judge who found Ríos Montt guilty played a historic and important role, and she upheld the rule of law. But what happened, despite the decision of the Constitutional Court to overturn the sentence, demonstrated that they weren't willing to uphold the law. And we see it as one more aggression or attack against the victims.
Have there been any challenges socially? Are people in Guatemala supportive of these actions, or is there still fear?
Bueno, hay un poquito de confusión.
The military continues to confuse people and to carry out these dirty strategies, dirty tricks like they did during the war. And so people continue to be confused. But little by little, people have have learned more and understand better. And we see that Riosman had immunity for many years. He just lost his immunity in 2012. So after his immunity was up and the case started to move forward, we saw that people began to understand more the work that we were doing. And so also the media, who's paid or whose interests lie with those very powerful in Guatemala, also confuse people intentionally through the things that they publish or say. But the most important thing is that through this trial, we were able to prove that genocide did occur and that people who have supported us in Guatemala and internationally were also able to understand that genocide occurred. And the sentence is something that we continue to keep alive. It's something that is a living document for us.
The U.S. supported the Guatemalan government during the time of the genocide. So what's the importance for you of coming to the U.S. and specifically to a place like Wyoming to share your story?
Pues para nosotros como...
So during the war, during the armed conflict, it was the government of Ronald Reagan who was involved. And so we think it's important to talk about what happened in Guatemala because justice is fundamental for all countries and for Guatemala in particular. And as human beings, we all have the right to justice, to memory, to the truth. And so what we're looking for is your solidarity so that justice can move forward in Guatemala because we think it's a fundamental pillar to strengthen democracy in our country. What we're asking people to do is to send a letter of pressure, of support for the Association for Justice and Reconciliation, urging the Guatemalan government to uphold national laws and international laws. We want people to pay attention to this case and pay attention to the victims because we're not looking for revenge. What we're looking for is to ensure that this never happens again.
Thank you so much for coming in to talk.
Gracias.
That was Anselmo Roldan Aguilar, president of Guatemala's Association for Justice and Reconciliation.
Coming up, the Budget Committee, Senator Enzi Disdains, a story about air quality monitoring in Converse County, and surface owners struggle with energy companies who want access to their land. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Willow Belden. Wyoming Senior Republican Senator Mike Enzi is on a special budget conference committee that he says has already become a moot point. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington on why he's given up on the group before it's really gotten to work.
Senator Mike Enzi, along with 17 Senate Republicans, voted against the final deal to reopen the federal government and avoid a potential default on the nation's debt. That deal to reopen the government, which passed without their votes, set up a budget conference committee, the goal of which is to come up with a budget outline by December 13th. Enzi is one of the biggest proponents of Congress doing its committee work and not just cobbling together last-minute deals. So why is he complaining about this formal budget conference committee?
Well, it's not regular order. This should have been done before April 15th. That's what the budget law requires.
Enzi says the conference committee's work should have been done months ago so that the Senate could have worked on actual spending bills, not mere budget outlines.
And had we started voting on those one a week starting in April, we would have been done well before October. There would have been no shutdown of the government. Every agency would know exactly what they could spend for the next year. That's how it's supposed to work. We have to get back to doing that.
But the government did shut down. New York Democrat Nita Lowey, who was also on the panel, says that fact increases pressure on Enzi and the 28 others to reach a deal now.
The shutdown cost our economy 120,000 jobs, billions in economic activity. This conference committee must be successful.
Most lawmakers hope sequestration, the indiscriminate budget cuts, can be rearranged by the committee. Many Democrats want it unwound completely. But Enzi says he doesn't mind having it on the books, even if many people back home hate it.
I'd like for sequestration to cut the worst first, and in that case, I'd like for it to stay in. It's the first time that we've reduced spending since the Korean War for 2 years in a row. So it is making a difference. We do have to reduce spending.
Enzi adds that the reductions need to be meaningful, unlike what he says the president has been doing.
He's been selective. And it shows up the discontinuance of the White House self-guided tours. That's an $18,000 cost every year. I don't know how you make $1 trillion savings out of that.
As for the pain being felt by sequestration, Enzi says programs like Head Start have faced bigger cuts under sequestration because bureaucrats have been hoarding money instead of distributing it to places like Wyoming.
The pain ought to be in Washington, not out where the kids live.
Democrats say sequestration could be easily unwound if Republicans like Enzi just agreed to tweak the tax code. Maryland's Chris Van Hollen is the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee. He says it's unhelpful that Enzi and the others in budget negotiations are rejecting tax reform from the get-go.
These tax loopholes are spending through the tax code, so we don't see any reason why you should leave these off the table. I mean, why do you want to protect special interest tax breaks for hedge fund managers?
Enzi says Democrats still haven't gotten the message from voters. He says they just want more taxes in order to get more spending.
They're playing politics with it, and they're trying to find ways to raise more revenue so that they can spend more. If it was raising more revenue to pay down the debt, there might be some common ground there, but it's raising more to be able to do a whole bunch of new programs. And I don't think that's what the American people want.
U.S. Representative Lowy, the New York Democrat, says this conference committee offers lawmakers in both parties a way to fix the economic damage caused by the shutdown.
This just amplifies the stakes of our conference committee's work, and I hope that our committee will really begin working in earnest toward an agreement in the coming days to prevent the economic damage that partisan politics and the sequester could cause in the coming months.
But Enzi isn't holding out any hope. He predicts lawmakers will merely fund the government at the same level as last year.
What I see coming out of it is not a budget committee deal, just another continuing resolution to allow government to spend the way that it's spending right now. And that isn't going to work either.
Enzi is hoping to use his perch on the budget conference committee to call for spending reforms and reductions. It's the same message he's been bringing for years, one that seems to perpetually fall on deaf ears. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Converse County is seeing an increasing amount of energy development, and some residents worry that air quality could suffer as a result. The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality and researchers from the University of Wyoming are now monitoring air quality in the area. On the whole, they found that the air is pretty clean, but they've also documented times when pollution levels have spiked. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
The concern that some residents and environmentalists have is that emissions from oil and gas development could lead to unhealthy levels of pollution. That's happened before, for example, around Pinedale. In that area, emissions from the natural gas industry caused a type of pollution called ozone to form, to a point where it violated federal air quality standards. So when oil wells started popping up near residential areas in Converse County, some people got nervous.
They have concerns about the air quality related to that oil and gas development, so that's why we decided to place a monitoring trailer there.
Kara Kessler supervises the air quality monitoring program for the Department of Environmental Quality. She says DEQ placed a monitoring station in Converse County last year to find out how clean the air is and to make sure any pollution doesn't exceed legal limits. The Bureau of Land Management also commissioned an air quality study in the area. They're expecting applications for more oil and gas drilling on federal land, and they want to use the data they're collecting to model how air quality might change with increased development. Karis Tours is their air quality specialist.
We use our analysis to determine if we authorize further development, is it going to add to that problem? And, you know, we certainly can't authorize anything that's going to violate an air quality standard.
The researcher who's conducting the study for the BLM is Rob Field. He's an atmospheric scientist at UW, and he's done extensive research into the ozone problem around Pinedale. He says so far in Converse County, there's good news. Pollution levels have been relatively low.
We've not encountered the level of emission plumes that certainly we found in the Pinedale Anticline project area. Will that change in the future? That's the question. That's why we're performing some more of these monitoring circuits and see how the air quality may evolve over time.
There were some instances where pollution levels spiked, though. One day in July, there was a lot of ozone in the air, and for a few days in August, there were high concentrations of carbon monoxide. Christy Mogan lives near Douglas. She says her family certainly noticed the pollution.
It was just really hard to breathe, and we were kind of thinking, well, did we catch a cold or something? It was just very hard to breathe. We've lived out there since 2004. We haven't ever felt like we couldn't breathe the air.
Nobody knows whether those pollution episodes had anything to do with the oil and gas industry. And the data that DEQ has collected this year does not indicate that federal air quality standards have been violated. One ozone episode does not constitute a violation. And this one wasn't specific to Converse County. High ozone levels were reported in Casper, Cheyenne, and parts of Colorado around the same time. So Kara Kessler with DEQ says residents shouldn't be alarmed.
No, I don't think we need to be concerned about violating the ozone standard at this point in time.
But just because air quality standards are okay now doesn't mean there couldn't be a problem in the future, given that more energy development is expected. Rob Field says he found that baseline levels of ozone in the area, in other words, the levels of ozone that are present pretty much all the time, were relatively high.
So you don't have to add very much ozone to breach a standard level.
In other words, if industry comes in, drills more wells, and creates just a little bit more ozone, it's possible that it could push the area over the legal limit. But we may not know if that happens. That's because it takes 3 years of data to determine if there's an ozone exceedance, and DEQ may not leave its monitoring station in Converse County that long. Again, DEQ's Kara Kessler.
It's pretty likely that it would move somewhere else after a year because we do have other areas that also need investigation. We've never had a case where we've left a trailer there long-term just based on that first year of data.
Environmental groups say that's a problem. They feel it's crucial to continue monitoring in an area like this where energy development is on the rise and to analyze the data carefully when permitting new development. Jill Morrison with the Powder River Basin Resource Council says she doesn't want Converse County to become another Pinedale.
The Green River Basin is in a non-attainment status, and that's as a result of natural gas development. We know, given the recent monitoring in the Powder River Basin and around Douglas, you know, we see the ozone values approaching the standard, and we know there's a lot more coming. It's just going to be so important for us to get out in front of this right now and do as much as we can to limit those emissions.
DEQ will complete its initial year of monitoring in December. After that, they'll decide whether to leave their monitoring station in Converse County. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
For most of Wyoming's history, mineral rights have clearly taken precedence over surface rights. But in 2005, the legislature passed a split estate law which, for the first time, gave surface owners some say over how their land could be used to access the minerals below. It was a big change, but many have argued since then it didn't go far enough. As Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, a case heard by the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission this week tested the limits of the law and the rights of surface owners.
The hearing was about an issue called seismic bonding. The name may be boring, but for Patrick and Sharon O'Toole, the issue is anything but. They own the Ladder Livestock Ranch in the Little Snake River Valley in southern Wyoming, and seismic bonding has caused massive upheaval in their lives over the last year. Patrick O'Toole.
The rules give them the opportunity to run over landowners, and they did.
The they is oil and gas company GRMR. GRMR owns the oil and gas estate below the O'Toole's surface property. The company approached the O'Toole's earlier this year asking for access to their property to conduct seismic testing, a process used to map the locations of oil-rich fractures. Sharon O'Toole says GRMR offered them the same deal it offered their neighbors.
You know, sign here. We don't pay any what's called trespass fee, commonly, but a surface use fee, which is absolutely the norm in the industry. And we'll pay for damages, but we get to decide what's damages.
Unimpressed by the offer, the O'Toole's refused. The exact details of the subsequent back and forth are in dispute, but the end result was that GRMR eventually went to the Oil and Gas Commission and asked for permission to access the land without the O'Toole's consent, through a process called bonding on. Effectively, GRMR asked to post a $13,000 bond to cover any potential damages in exchange for the commission overriding the O'Toole's objections. Pat O'Toole says it came as a shock that the company could do that.
You know, you tell somebody what happened, they go, "That never happened to me. I wouldn't let anybody on my land, or they're not going to do that to me." Well, they will.
The commission approved GRMR's request and gave its blessing for the company to move forward with seismic testing. In this case, that involves setting off buried dynamite charges, then recording the energy waves that are produced. GRMR says it's incredibly low impact, especially relative to other forms of seismic testing. The O'Toole's disagree. They say the helicopters that the company uses to move equipment have scared away game in the area and that the blast could ruin their water wells. To them, the $13,000 bond didn't take into account those disruptions. And so, for the first time in Wyoming history, they challenged the bond amount set by the commission.
Docket number 715-2013, the Ladder Livestock Company et al., and the objection to the seismic bond.
The hearing process closely resembles a trial, with each side having the opportunity to call witnesses and introduce evidence into the record. Typically, both parties would be represented by an attorney. GRMR hired Lynn Boomgartner, a former oil and gas commissioner, but the O'Tooles opted to represent themselves. Because of the commission's rules, that meant they weren't allowed to cross-examine GRMR's witnesses or challenge its evidence. So after several hours of testimony from GRMR employees, a round of posters, and the video deposition of a land expert, the O'Tooles still hadn't spoken. Instead, the commissioners asked the company questions. State geologist Tom Dream.
I would like to hear why this is lower impact than other programs.
Governor Matt Mead.
And you don't believe your activities reduce the hunting opportunities?
Ultimately satisfied with the answers they received to those questions and others, the commissioners voted unanimously to uphold the bond, saying the law only allows them to take into account concrete damages and that the O'Toole's concerns about hunting and well damage were vague and unsubstantiated. So where does that leave the O'Toole's? Patrick says it raises a fundamental question for him about what the state values.
Why did their, you know, their activities take precedence, not just over us, but over every public land hunter in southern Wyoming? That's what happened.
He's planning to lobby the legislature for changes to the split estate law. But in the meantime, the fight over bonding may not be over. If GRMR finds exploitable deposits underneath the O'Toole's property, the two will once again have to try and negotiate a surface use agreement. And in light of the outcome of the seismic bond proceeding, Sharon O'Toole says it's not clear that they'll have much leverage.
I don't know what sort of due process we have available to us.
For now, the answer might just be none. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Coming up, an interview about an ambitious production of Carmina Burana and lessons for when one is lost. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Willow Belden. One of classical music's most famous pieces is not normally performed the way the composer conceived it. But next week, the University of Wyoming is staging Carmina Burana the way Carl Orff intended, with dancers and actors alongside the orchestra and choral, 150 performers on stage at once. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer spoke with UW dance professor and choreographer Lawrence Jackson.
It's a massive undertaking, and I think just in the whole staging of the whole thing, it's just been a lot of collaboration with the scenic designer, trying to figure out where we put all these people on stage. And it's been my vision, but a collaborative effort between the music department, the theater and dance department. So it's a lot of heads working together.
So tell me a little bit about what Carmina Burana is about. It's based on a collection of poems mm-hmm. from the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries.
Right.
They're written in Latin, Middle High German, Old French, mm-hmm. Provençal.
Originally, it was written around the 11th, 12th, 13th century by Benedictine monks who wrote a collection of 254 poems and dramatic texts, actually. And so what Carl Orff did in 1937 was he took a collection of 24 of those songs from the original 254 and created this musical masterpiece. And within the Carmina Burana Carl Orff version, there are three themes that are essentially discussed: the theme of love, the theme of misfortune, and also the theme of just the ramifications of alcohol. And so those are essentially the three major themes. The piece actually opens with O Fortuna, which is
that's a hugely famous piece.
Right,
I mean, it's
right.
in every movie's dramatic climax.
Right.
That's the piece that
yeah,
plays, right?
Yeah, and it actually has been played by the UW band on the football field. So it opens and closes the piece. The piece essentially is about a Roman goddess who is the goddess of fortune, and she essentially is responsible for spinning her fortune wheel, and wherever the wheel lands, that determines what your fate is at that moment in time.
So from happiness to misfortune, sort of the capricious nature of life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so in the three scenes, you find that the wheel lands in three different places. And so then you explore those themes in those particular scenes. And then we come back to the beginning. And so it shows just how life is repetitive. You sort of kind of recycle through the same periods of time.
Now, a production of this size must have tremendous challenges that you're probably in the middle of right now as you're preparing for the show's opening. So on the musical side, this is a piece of work that shifts rhythm, from measure to measure. You're going from 7-beat measures to 4-beat measures to just all over the place.
Right.
You have a massive range for the singers. In one of the songs, the only tenor solo has to sing entirely falsetto because he's representing a swan being roasted at a feast.
Right. There are three music faculty who will be performing because the works are very, very difficult to perform. Yeah, they're intense. From a choreographic standpoint, it's intense because you have to segue quickly from one emotion to the next and to try to get the dancers to completely transform their character from one scene to the next is definitely challenging. And then also just working with live music, most dancers in their lifetime will never work with live accompaniment. So that's difficult because you never know what you're going to get every night. And we have to, the music and the dance has to come together as one cohesive element. And so we have really been working to try to figure out, what would happen if the music goes in this direction one night and what happens if it goes in that direction. So it's definitely been challenging on a lot of fronts and just bringing, like you said, bringing so many different people together to be on one accord is just a huge undertaking and can get quite stressful at times because you have so many different ideas bouncing off of each other and everybody's trying to put their best ideas forward and you have to take everybody's ideas into consideration. And so all of that usually falls into my lap and then I make the artistic decisions. And then working with people that are outside of my discipline, I'm having to understand musical language and then communicate effectively to the musicians what it is that I'm trying to do at this particular scene. And then they're trying to learn my language. And so it's definitely been challenging in that arena, but educational at the same time.
So aside from the fact that this big creative work that you're doing is going to help you get tenure, what's been most rewarding about this project?
Well, I've always wanted to do Carmina Burana, but before I came to the university, I was a professional dancer, and then after that, I went to graduate school. And oftentimes, choreographers and artistic directors don't get to do a work of this magnitude with live accompaniment. Most people who have choreographed Carmina Burana have done it with a recording, mostly because it's quite expensive to do with the copyright issues and copyright fees. And so it's not often done. And this is, for me, probably a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity because it's very, very expensive to do. And you oftentimes don't have the resources in terms of an orchestra and a chorale to work alongside you. So I think for me, it's just probably at this point in my career, it's probably the pinnacle of my choreographic career because it's very unique in that, many choreographers will never have this opportunity.
Carmina Burana opens at the University of Wyoming on November 19th. It runs through the 24th, and Lawrence Jackson is the choreographer and the mind behind all of this action on the stage. Thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Thank you, Micah.
Wyoming's quiet, wild spaces attract adventurers from near and far, but we also hear frequently about adventures gone wrong. Throughout the Mountain West, we hear stories of people who go missing. By day, Scott Hammond is a management professor at Utah State University, but in his free time, he's a volunteer search and rescuer with Rocky Mountain Rescue Dogs. Hammond spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez about his new book, Lessons of the Lost, which details his experiences with the search and rescue organization.
I've been in a lot of situations in the mountains where I wished I could help someone, and you feel helpless, or you see someone who's panicking because they've lost someone. I've also been in personal situations where I felt lost myself, and so I started getting interested in how people and why people get lost. And it seemed natural to then take that into the wilderness, but I quickly realized that it's not just a wilderness issue. We get lost in life as well.
Getting to the more literal sense of being lost, say, in the wilderness, you have a chapter devoted to lessons of the lost, getting into the psyche of lost people and offer advice for being found. If you would, please read from the first lesson of The Lost.
The first lesson of The Lost is that survival is insufficient. The survival zone is a place where you should spend as little time as possible. Survival establishes a minimum level of physical and emotional and social needs and will deteriorate quickly. This is the tipping point between yes and no, making it or not, death and life. It is the point of maximum misery. Consider a desert survival situation where you have just enough water and food to stay alive. The heat during the day is paralyzing. The cold during the night is overwhelming. One wrong move, one break from the shade or a spill of the cup, and you pass the tipping point to death. Think of the stress of living in a place, in work, in life, in the wilderness, where you are always looking over their edge, wondering if you might perish. Survivors need to move as quickly as possible into a position of thriving in at least one area. What I was really trying to say there is that, you know, we think about survival, and there are all kinds of programs about survival skills and how to do this and how to do that in the wilderness or even in life. And the truth of the matter is survival is a really inefficient place to be. It may be the first step towards thriving, but go through it quickly.
In your book, you feature stories of survivors, people who became lost, and early in the book, you talk about a woman named Victoria struggled to survive in the wilderness. Could you tell me about her?
Yeah, Victoria Grover is a physician's assistant who went lost in the southern Utah desert, and she had been in that desert before on a survival class. She decided to go back on some day hikes. She was solo hiking, and she had told the hotel to expect her back at a certain time. And she just got too far down the trail, and so she turned around and built a fire and decided to overnight. And the next morning as she was going out, she broke her leg on the way out. And she was there for 4 days waiting for a rescue. She was in a place where no one could see her. There was a stream about 40 yards away, but she couldn't get there with a broken leg. And she sat there and visioned this whole thing out and realized that she had been thinking about it in the wrong way, that if she started to think about turning herself around, her body around, and going backwards, that she could get to the stream. And so she pushed herself along with her legs, going backwards, and then as she went along, she collected leaves and she collected anything that would burn in her little plastic poncho. And when she got to the stream, she got the water that she needed, and then she built a fire with what she had collected and buried the fire in the sand and sat on the sand to keep her warm in the first night. That kind of creative thinking is what all people who survived have to do. You have to see it differently in order to be able to solve the problem.
The way you found out about this story is because you interviewed her a few days after she was rescued. What's it like to interview people after these harrowing experiences?
You know, these are the most sacred stories that people have in their whole lives. They're just so deep and profound, and they're life-changing experiences. For Victoria, 2 years later, she has a completely different life. And one of the points I make in the book is that lost people, you know, they vision the home that they know, but you never come home to the same place. You're always a different person once you've been lost.
It's clear from reading through your book that you're not only talking about people whose hikes or road trips have gone wrong. You're also trying to explore what it means to be lost and how people can get out of that state, even in life. Tell me more about why you decided to make that link in your book.
For me, it came from a very personal experience. The second search I was called on was for my own brother-in-law. And I had seen him take one step and then another step into this self-made wilderness of his own. But he had just lost his job. He had gone through a messy divorce. He was separating from his family. He was becoming more and more isolated. He couldn't find work. And over time, that led him to drive his car into the woods and walk away. And it moved me deeply in that I saw the relationship between how his lost in the woods was related to his lost in life.
Scott, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Take care.
Scott Hammond is a professor at Utah State University, a volunteer with Rocky Mountain Rescue Dogs, and the author of Lessons of the Lost, Finding Hope and Resilience in Work, Life, and Wilderness.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear it again, listen to individual segments, or listen to previous episodes, you can go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and click on Open Spaces.
You can also submit ideas for future programs on that website and comment on our stories. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and you can find all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.